thank everybody for coming. And let's give our warm-up speaker, Kirby, a warm welcome.
Hi, my name is Kirby, and I'm an alcoholic. Wow, haven't done this in a while, and certainly not at a podium. Do a lot of meetings, but not actually having to stand up, and it makes a huge difference. You know, it really makes a little bit of a difference, and not to have that, you know, anything in front, so you can't stand here and do a little dance around. And, I'm really grateful to be here tonight. I am so thankful for the opportunity to come and share the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is what it's about for me, you know, being able to give something back to a program that has absolutely, I wouldn't say it saved my life as much as gave me a life, because I know before I got here, I didn't have one. As we were, you know, reading through the steps and how it works, sitting there listening, and my grand sponsor used to be a circuit speaker, and so, you know, she has this thing where you go to a meeting, you sit there, and by God, you pay attention to you know, what the readings that are done at the beginning of this of every meeting, because that's what's going to save your life. You know, pay attention, bring a book. I always I have it on my iPhone, so I don't have to actually carry my book to a lot of meetings. That way I always have my phone with me, and I get to follow along. You know, I got here, let's see, August 3rd, 1992. It's me 20 years this last year. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it wasn't my intent to stay this long. All I know is I wanted to stop the pain. I wanted to stop the hurting that was going on in my life, and there had been a lot of it. You know, I'm one of those kids who comes from, like most of us these days, that come from a broken home. I have my mother is bipolar. I've been schizophrenic, in and out of mental institutions. My father was a sailor. He got pregnant with me when my mother was 15 years old and my dad was 18. And it's been a series of marriages and divorces for them throughout my life. I'm working on number five marriages by my mother and five by my father. So, you know, throughout the years you learn a lot of adaptation, a lot of change. And what I learned from that is to be a chameleon. You know, you put me in any situation, and I'm going to stand back for a minute, I'm going to look around, and I'm going to watch you, see how you do it, so that when I go out and do it, I'm not going to look like an idiot, you know, when I try to do something. And so I certainly have done that in pretty much every aspect of my life. You know, I know what those feelings growing up of insecurity and abandonment issues and feeling that hole that in, you know, deep inside your soul for a long, long time. I knew what that was like. The only stable force in my life at that time growing up had been my grandparents. My mother's parents were Pentecostal ministers, and so we would bounce back and forth between whatever marriage my mother was in to my grandparents and all around, and you know, that has its own set of issues. And so I've been primarily raised by my maternal grandparents. So you add, you know, don't drink, don't smoke, you know, don't cut, don't chase the women, and whatever it is on top of all the other chaos that you're seeing in your life. And it makes for a really screwed up childhood. Except that, you know, my grandparents were probably the most loving people in the world. And for me, that was always home, because I knew it was safe no matter what was going on. I'm the oldest of the kids on both sides of my family. So I got to see all of it, and I'm one of those unfortunate or fortunate, depending on how you look at it, people who has, as my mother calls it, a memory of an elephant. I can remember back to being 3 years old. So in addition to all of those feelings, I remember the events that went around that. You add that to the fact that while I had several blackout drunks, I remember most every drunk that I ever had. I remember the very first drink that I did have. I had an accident with my mom. I was 7 years old, walking into the kitchen. We lived in Oklahoma at the time. She was on marriage number two, and my mom was boiling a pot of tea, and I happened to come running into the kitchen, and she was going from the stove to the sink with a pan of tea to take it over and pour it in the pitcher. She didn't see me, and I didn't see her, and that tea went straight down my back, and it was boiling. Well, the only thing that my mother knew how to do at that time was, give you a shot of whiskey, and threw me in a bathtub, cold water. So, I think both of those things were smart, good decisions, and yet not so good decisions, at least on the alcohol part. But I remember that drink. I remember the warm feeling. I remember that more than I do the pain of the tea. Just that moment, it was like the little light bulb went on, and I knew, wow, that hit the spot. That feels really good, and I don't hurt as bad. So, growing up, I found that alcohol fit every pain, every little thing that I felt or didn't want to feel. Alcohol was it for me. It definitely numbed all the hurts that were going on. We moved an awful lot as a kid, so probably on average 2 to 3 times a year throughout my entire education. So, I knew what it was like to be that new kid forever. I got to the point where I didn't make friends, and truly the only friend that I did have was alcohol. By the time that I was 16 years old, I realized that I came to some big conclusions in my life and knew that I needed to make some changes. I realized at that point that I was gay, and my grandmother, my grandfather had since passed, my grandmother and I kind of had a parting of the ways. She didn't like my ways, and I parted, and drinking and partying and using whatever I could was pretty much on. I had I knew for a long time that there was something wrong. I knew that I had that hole that was inside my soul. You just know there's something wrong with you, and for those of us who have made it into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and have found a life and have some recovery and good sobriety, you realize that the problem started way back in the beginning, at that very first drink, and I never really understood that. By the time that I realized that I had a problem, I had gone through that whole list of things as we were in the reading talking about, I think the only thing I didn't do was switch from brandy, from scotch. I had joined the military when I was 20 years old, joined the Navy. My dad's I'm fourth generation on my father's side, and so for me that was just a natural progression to do, where I learned how to actually drink scotch and found that I liked that a lot. So that was about the only thing that I didn't try. But everything else, I knew there was something wrong. I knew that I needed to, I did the therapy. I did the moves. I did the changing of the jobs. I, didn't drink at home. I would do everything I possibly could to make me feel better without really looking what the true problem was. I actually even wound up in a stint at Charter Hospital in Bakersfield on the psych side, because I had a psychiatrist who asked me if I had a problem, and of course my answer was no. Previously, a couple of months earlier, I had a total hysterectomy. So, you know, it's got to be that. That has to be what's really wrong with me. It's not anything else. So I come out of Charter Hospital, and of course I go through the whole program. They tell me, you know, you need to go get this Emotions Anonymous book and go through the Emotions Anonymous program. And I, you know, like, okay, I can do that. So I had two emotions. I had when I was really happy, which wasn't very often, and when I was sad, I would turn that into anger because I knew how to process anger, you know. Nothing in between. And at Charter Hospital, they give you the little charts of all the little different faces, you know, a little smiley face, a little frown, you know, everything. Told me to put it on my refrigerator, and then that way I could identify what feeling I might be having that particular day. So I go up to the Bay Area, and I go to a recovery bookstore with my cousin and her roommate, who at that time had 5 and 7 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they take me in there, and I asked my cousin's roommate, how do you know if you're an alcoholic? What I've come to know today is that people who are not alcoholics don't ever ask that question. You know? Nobody really starts to think about that unless they truly have a problem, unless there's something really wrong. And, you know, to me it just seemed like, well, I haven't tried that one yet, so she said, it's fine that you should ask, because we have this checklist of 20 questions. You know, why don't you take this checklist and go answer them as honestly as you possibly can. So I go outside and I sit there in her car, and you know, for the first time in my life, I got really, really honest. I got honest with myself. And that is something that, you know, the Big Book talks about. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And, you know, the people who can't do so, you know, are, oh, what is it? It's, I have it. I can say it. You know, Rachel, right along with you. Here we go. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. For that moment, and I don't know where it came from, but for that first moment, I actually got really honest with myself, and I answered those 20 questions. And I got down to the bottom of it, and you know, I'm reading, and it says, if you have answered yes to one or two questions, you may want to talk to somebody about your drinking. If you've answered yes to three questions, chances are you may have a problem with your drinking. If you answered yes to four or more, you definitely, you know, you do have a problem with alcoholism. I answered yes to 7 of those questions, and all I could do is sit there and cry. You know, it's that moment where, oh my God, this is what it is. This is truly what is wrong. This is the broken piece that I haven't been able to figure out. Because for all those years previous, you know, at this point I'm 27 years old and I've been drinking on and off for 20 years. You know, I was getting to where I was becoming a daily drinker. I did it through the years previous, but, you know, as time goes on and all the stuff happens in your life, you know, you tend to turn to the bottle a little bit more and a little bit more. At least that's what happened in my case. Finally, the pieces all fell together and I realized, you know what, I really do have a problem. And there is, you know, this is it. So my cousin's roommate comes out and she says, well, and I sit there and I tell her what's going on. And she says, you know, if you're still not sure, just go 30 days and don't drink. And I'm going, cool, I can do that. Man, I'm going to get through a boot camp. You know, that's 2 months. I can do that, piece of cake, you know. But, okay. We got back to their place. I got a call from a friend, and they said, well, we're going to go out for a pitcher of margaritas. You want to go? Absolutely, I'm right there. You know, so much for resolve, so much for not being able to hold out for 30 days. It took me a couple of more weeks before I finally made it into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous and decided to really stay. What I know today, looking back on that period of time, is that I did what I needed to do to make sure that this is really truly what I wanted. This is where I needed to be. I watched people with good recovery. Looked at them. You know, I'm that chameleon. I'm the one who stands in the corner and looks to see what all of you people are doing. And I found that the people who have lives today are people who come to meetings, who get a sponsor, who get a book, who read the book, read the black parts. Not the white. There's nothing in there. This isn't the secret. There's nothing, you know, hidden message written in between. It is exactly what it is. It says exactly what it means. And if you are willing to do that, then you have a chance at a life. You know, I never had friends. I didn't know what friends were because growing up, you know, we moved so often, it got to the point where I'm not even going to bother to attempt to make friends. So that was not a lesson I ever learned how to do. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I started sticking with the winners. I started, you know, being with people who had good quality time. I got a sponsor. I began to work the steps, and my life changed. I actually got a life. I got to experience things that I never in a million years ever dreamed I would get to experience. In sobriety, I've managed to put together 23 years at the company that I work for, because I was really crappy as an employee the first couple of years that I was there, and you know, I get the opportunity to be of service. My sponsor reminds me that my purpose today is to be of maximum service to God and to my fellows, in whatever capacity that means. And, you know, it happens just however it happens. You know, God puts me where He wants me to be for that particular day, and I just have to be willing to keep my ears open and my mouth shut and do the footwork. And sometimes that's really, really hard. Sometimes that is the most challenging thing, to keep my mouth shut and just be still. But as long as I continue to go to meetings, read the book, work steps with my sponsor, who actually is somebody that I have had the best relationship in my life with. I've had the same sponsor for the last 15 years. You know, that relationship is one of the most wonderful, amazing relationships that I have ever had in my life. I have somebody that I can talk to about anything and everything. And actually, in sobriety, I have had the opportunity to have real friends, to know what it's like to have true friends. You know, people that I know that I can call at a moment's notice, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, no matter what's going on in my life or what's going on in their life, because they're people in recovery too, who, you know, live a life of sobriety, who live a life of honesty and integrity most days. You know, we all have our moments, and but I can call them at any time and say, hey, I need some help, or, you know, hey, I was just thinking of you. And I guarantee you I didn't do that much at all when I was still out there drinking and using. You know, it was whoever was there is, you know, do that kind of barely, you know, I know you, but I don't want you to know me. I don't want to get into your business because I definitely don't want you in my business. And that today that's not the case. I have those, I have friends. You know, I have people in my life that I can call. I have a life that I never ever imagined that I could possibly have. I've been able to, in sobriety, go back to school. I didn't finish high school the first time around, and I went back and got my GED. Initially, I got my GED, went back and got my high school diploma, and then I got to go back to school. It took me 8.5 years in sobriety, and I got my bachelor's degree. You know, my sister and I had the opportunity a year and a half ago to go to Europe. You know, I'm the kid on welfare and who bounced all over the place. And last year we got to go for 17 days and travel across Europe and see stuff. And I never, ever would have imagined that I would have opportunities like that when I was still sitting on a bar stool or when I was still holed up inside my home drinking, because at that point when I got to the end, it was, I didn't want anything to do with anybody else. You know, I didn't want to drink in the bar. It was at home. So that is not what my life is like today. And if you want a life, if you want real, true friends, if you want real happiness in your life, Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps will take you there. Alcoholics Anonymous and the people in this room will take you there, as long as you're willing to do the footwork. And today, you know, just over 20 years later, I'm still willing to do the footwork. I still work with my sponsor. We still go back through the steps. No matter how many times I've done them, I learn something new. Uncover, discover, and discard. And that's what I get to do today. I don't have to keep holding on to the same old crap. You know, I have a life, and Alcoholics Anonymous has given me that life. So I thank you for the opportunity to come and talk tonight, and God bless you all. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous.
Everybody would be so kind to take their seats. Let's give our featured speaker from Fresno, Bear, a big round of applause. How y'all doing? My name's Bear, and I am a stepchild. That's stepchild, man. Well, everything Kirby said, I'm the opposite of. So, you got it, let's go home. I gotta tell y'all, I'm a little nervous. Billy doesn't believe that. Billy and Holden. You know, I walk around the run site, and I'm a cocky son of a gun. I got to tell you first, I cuss, so if that offends anybody, sorry. I get someplace new, and I'm painfully shy. So bear with me, please. No pun intended. You know what? It wasn't very long in my life when I absolutely knew I was different. I knew from a very, very early age that I wasn't exactly going to be the person my mama thought. Or my dad. Differently than Kirby, my parents were married for many, 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 many years. Even though we asked them not to be. George and Norma, they hung in there. God bless them. And, So I knew I would never give my mother grandbabies, and I knew that I would never be a secretary for my dad, because that was his life ambitions for me, to be a secretary.
And this is me. Actually, I'm a paralegal. I can come close, huh? Yeah, I can come close. You know, I can't tell you when I had my first drink of alcohol. I was way too little to remember that. I don't have the memory that Kirby has. I can tell you that the only picture I have of me and my maternal grandfather is I'm about this high in this funky little dress they put me in. I don't know where that came from. And he's handed me a beer. You know, I grew up sipping beers. My father was not an alcoholic. My mother was not an alcoholic. They absolutely had the disease of addiction, but it wasn't about alcohol or it wasn't about drugs. You know, once in a while he'd say, hey, go get me a beer out of the refrigerator, and if we got to be the ones to go get it, we were allowed to take a sip or two, and you know, when it was my turn and it got back to him, it was at least half empty. And we didn't have that big of a house, so it was just a few sips, you know. So I really started abusing substances. I'm duly addicted. I'm addicted to anything. If it makes me feel better, if it makes me see funny colors, if it makes me warm and fuzzy, I'll take it, drink it, swallow it. The only thing I didn't do was IV drugs, because I have tattoos everywhere, but I'm afraid of needles. Does that make sense to y'all? But really, that kicked in about the age of 11. I grew up in Bakersfield, and for those of you that are familiar with Bakersfield, there's not much to do down there now, and there certainly wasn't 40 years ago. You either went to a few bars, or you went to church, and most of us did both. You know, you go out and rip a good one on Saturday night and go to church on Sunday. You know, so by the time I reached seventh grade, I was doing a lot of drinking, kitchen school, drinking in this little alleyway that we used to go hide in, and doing some drugs. I started smoking dope when I was 11. I guess that was probably the big defining year of my life. And, you know, at some point in there, you know, if I was old enough and mature enough to recognize, you know, they talk about those light bulbs that go off, or we say in the program, that big red flag, you know. There were, looking back on it, there was a few that maybe, had I been old enough, I could have paid attention to, you know. My father bought his business. He was a diesel repair road service man. And in order for my mother to communicate with him, he put in CB radios. And if any of y'all are familiar with that, when you got a TV radio, you got to pick out yourself a handle, which is, in my world today, we call it a road name. And so my mother's going, well, I think you ought to be the nugget. I'm sitting there going, I'm going to be called the pusher. You know, because at that time in my life, a pusher was a drug dealer. And that fascinated me. The whole world of alcohol and drug use and going to the bar and having lots of cash and all that stuff. It just fascinated me, man. I thought if I could get there, I made it. I made something of myself, you know. I guess my father's life ambitions were better than mine. So very early on, I was heading there. And I got into high school. I had an older brother. He was also heading there. He taught me how to really get to school and have a good time. I managed to get myself kicked out of my freshman year of high school, not only out of school, but out of the entire district. Had to go to another district, and I missed the whole first half, or the whole first semester. Just didn't bother me. You know, none of that stuff bothered me. I was growing up different, you know, and at that time, I was not accepted in life. I was horrible. That's what I heard on TV. That's what I heard from church. That's what I heard from some family members. I never heard it from my mom and dad, I have to say. You know, I was a deviant. I was a sexual offender. I was all these things just because I was a girl, you know. And I just couldn't get past hanging out, making somebody dinner, and running them a bath at the end of the day. That's not for me either, you know. So, you know, I spent my high school, I found my little niche in high school, which, you know, I hung out with the stoners, and that's what we did. We drank a lot. We smoked as much as we could. We did school as much as we could. And I got in a lot of trouble. I got grounded a lot. But my mom and dad were kind of like, if they grounded you for a week, it usually lasted about 3 days. If we got grounded for 2 weeks, it usually lasted about five. Because they didn't want to stay home and watch us, right? So here you've been good for 3 hours. Get out of here, you know. And I was the baby of the family, and I was very spoiled. And I'm still the baby of the family, and I'm still very spoiled. And you know, so I'm sure that didn't help. And I also learned just how far I could push them from my older siblings, because they would get in a lot of trouble, and I said, well, I can push it to this point, and I'm not going to get in trouble. So I learned how to do that, and I learned how to manipulate them, specifically my mother. She was the best codependent God ever created. And so I got through high school. I managed to throw in some grades. I didn't graduate. I quit the last semester of my senior year. I decided I was going to go into the Navy. And they decided they didn't want me. And I said, well, fuck you. I'll go to the Army. And then the recruiter lied to me, and I said, fuck you too. Now what do I do? Well, I'll just go get a job. And so I did that. And then when I turned 18, it was like, the carpet was burning. I was out of that house as fast as I could get, and my brother was living in Arizona, and you know, the drinking age in Arizona was only 19 years old, and I looked a lot older than 19, so off to Arizona I went. And that's when my addictions really, really, really took hold of me. Where I lived in Arizona, you couldn't get a lot of dope, so it was 99.99.99% alcohol. Well, for a great while, we could get a bag of weed, and that was it. And I lived there 3 years, and I don't really remember much of it. I have some vague pictures of a couple of bars. I don't know, we used to mix up gin and Country Time lemonade in these big gallon jugs and throw them in the back seat of the car, and then we'd go riding around the desert. And I remember we went out one night, we left the house about 4:35 o'clock, and it was me and my girlfriend, and I look up to Phoenix, 10 miles. And I live 6 hours from Phoenix. I have no idea how I got there, you know, and I wound up having to call into work, because I worked for her mother, and took quite a bit of time off because I had to go hustle up money for gas money to get home on. I didn't have any money. I spent it all on gin and lemonade in the back seat. So we found this bar in Phoenix that we were winning a little bit of money shooting pool on, and they let us sleep there a couple of nights because we really honestly had no place to go but that in the car. And had a lot of glass from the jugs in the car, back to the car, so that was kind of dangerous. And so we stayed there a couple of nights and managed to find my way home, but that was just how I was. You know, I flew by the seat of my ass, and I'd get myself into any situation. If it even remotely seemed like it was going to be a fun time, I was there. I was on. You know, like Kirk said, she was like a chameleon. She blended in till she figured out how she had to be. I was in feet first, head first, whole body first. It didn't matter, you know. And then if it turned out badly, then I'd sit there and kind of scratch my head and say, well, what the hell did I do wrong, you know? And so I finally told her at one point that I was going to stop drinking because I realized that when I went into the bathroom, my urine smelled like Miller Lite. And I swear to God it did. Swear to God. And And, you know, she beat the hell out of me for that decision, if I remember right. And I never hit her back. I was brought up with, you don't do that. So I just let her do it. She was pretty pissed off over it. So I stayed a couple more months. And right around my 21st birthday, my parents came out. And it's the only time my father ever told me he loved me. And it was, he was packing the car and they were getting ready to leave. And he kind of mumbled something like, you know, well, we love you and want you to come home. And I barely heard it. And my mother and I both just went, did you hear that? And I thought, he loves me now, you know. Even if I'm a queer, he loves me. So back to Bakersfield I went with my girlfriend, who my mother said, don't bring anybody but you, which, why should I listen to that? I never listened to her for the last 21 years. And so I showed up there. I went through very hard times with my family. It was hard. It was hard for them. My family, they didn't understand me. And I didn't understand why they didn't understand and accept me. And my father, you know, the only thing he told me is you're not sick in the head, so knock off your shit. That was therapeutic. And my mother would say, are you still that way? What way is that, Mom? You know. No. And you know, I was so angry at her, I would just pump it until I made her say it. And there was just a lot of anger going on. It took a couple of years, and then I started getting okay with that part of my life, you know. And I think the person I was with at the time helped a lot. They really took care for her, and she had a couple of kids. And my parents are actually known, grandparents they know, so it helped a lot. Well, then she was limiting my drinking, and certainly limited any of my drug addiction going on. She didn't let me smoke dope. She didn't let me take anything. She wouldn't let me snort any emo nitrate. She wouldn't let me do any of that fun shit that I like to do when we went out. So therefore, I don't want to be with you anymore. So I started this whole series of a pattern where you hook up, and no matter what type of person that was, I would see something in that person that became the entire being of the person that I wanted to be with. I don't know if that makes sense to you guys. And I tried very, very hard to make that person with that one little small thing I saw become this person with everything that I wanted in a partner and a mate. I wanted the longevity that my grandparents and my parents had. I wanted the shit you saw on TV. I wanted Ozzy and Harriet. You know, my parents are great parents, but we certainly were not issue-free in my house. We had a lot of dysfunction going on. They did not, I only heard my father tell my mother he loved her once, and that was when he was drunk. And I never heard my mother say it until just before he died. But I know today they loved each other a lot. And I guess I knew that back then. And that's what I wanted. And I wanted a good life. I wanted a house. I wanted all those things that make you think like you've made it in the world today. I wanted a good retirement. I wanted a Harley. I want. Everything on the outside. I figured if I got all these things and I got that perfect mate and all this stuff, I could create that and make me happy. And I would be accepted because throughout all this time, I still knew that I felt different inside and I absolutely was different on the outside. You know, I'm like a walking billboard. I've been, as I can here, just like this forever. I don't know how to be in the closet. I didn't know how to be something I wasn't. It was real difficult for me. And I got teased a lot. I got in a lot of fights. You know, puts back on the, you know, I was queer. I was also fat. So that's a double whammy. You know, they talk about bullies. They got nothing on what we grew up with. So, they got guns now. I just kept drinking through it and going through relationships. Basically, is how it went. You know, you tell me you're leaving me at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I quite frankly didn't give a fuck, because by 6 o'clock the bar opened, and at 6:30 I'd have a new one. You know, these guys are here that have known me for a few years, and my friends in the background can tell you that it was, you know, the flavor of the year, at least. There was a new person. Quit looking at me, watch. There was a new person. She's talking about folks down there. Sometimes it was flavor of the month. I reaped a lot of damage because those people didn't deserve what I gave them. You know, because I made promises too, and they had their own dreams too, and what I gave them was an out of control drunken drug addict. That I wanted all this stuff to happen, but I wasn't willing to do the work for it. I just wanted it. For some reason, I just thought it was going to come to me. I just figured that if I actually lived past 30, I wouldn't need that retirement because somehow it would come to me. You know? Well, I figured it would come to me in my inheritance. That didn't happen either, by the way. And, flipping stock market. And, I was a thief. I let that part out. I told you I was a blackout. I didn't realize I was a blackout until I was about 10 years sober. But I was a thief. And I stole primarily from my parents' business. My father, he would have tons of cash in his pocket because he dealt primarily in cash when he'd go out and fix a truck or do whatever. My mother would too. My brothers were thieves too, so we learned how to get into the safe. We learned how to get into the money box real early, and this was in high school. So, you know, my dad never changed the combination to anything. He never changed the box. He never changed the safe. You know, I went into their house one time. I was 20, it was right before I got sober, 26, 27. And I walked into the room, and I just happened to hit the handle on the safe, and it popped open, and I'm like, cool. And I open up the little money box, and here's an envelope, and it's like, thick, man. I'm fucking, I'm bored, you know. Grabbed it, threw the door shut, out the house I went. And I go back to my house, which, by the way, was one of their houses that I lived in that I never paid rent for. I told you I was the baby. And I pulled this envelope out of my pocket, and in my father's handwriting, it said mother's on it, which means it was my grandparents' money. There was $10,000 in that envelope. And I said, ah, fuck, I can't steal from my grandma and grandpa. So I drove back out to my mom and dad's house, went back in the house, and the door on the safe, I couldn't get it back open. So at that point, well, what do I do? I'm fucked now. I might as well send it. Right? Because I couldn't tell them that I took it out with the intent of stealing it. And so, I don't know, about 3 days, I have no idea where that money went. No idea what happened to it. I know I had a hell of a party. And, absolutely nothing for it. Didn't even have a pair of shoes to show for it. It went to the bar. It went up my nose. I was doing a lot of crank at that time. And bought some good weed. Bought a few kegs. A couple of bottles of Jack Daniels. You know, the essentials of life. And then I got to where... Then I went to work for them. So now I'm living in one of their houses, not paying rent. And I'm living, and then I'm working for them. Not really doing much. I'd kind of show up for work, and I'd have to maybe go out and get my grandma and take her to the doctor's office. Or, you know, maybe sweep the floor or the shop or something. Nothing strenuous. And so we got paid on Mondays. She would never pay us on Fridays because she didn't want us to spend our checks during the weekend. So we got paid on Mondays, and I'd go in and to my sister-in-law, who also worked there, and said, here, I want to cash my check. So they'd cash the check out of the box. And then when everybody else went to lunch, I'd go in and steal my check back out, and I'd black over the deposits, the bonus thing, and then I'd take it down to the store and cash it again. good, huh? And I would also take checks out of the check register, sign my mother's name to them, $800,000, $900,000. You know, back then that was a lot of money. Take it down to a little liquor store, cash it. Now I got my check twice, another grand on top of it. I was set, you know, for the week. And so one day, skipping ahead of quite a few years here, one day this guy from the little liquor store called the shop, asked my dad, hey, do you know this person's been in, I don't know, 4 or 5 weeks in a row with these checks for $6,000 to $8,000. Are you guys writing these? Well, my dad never wrote a check. It was all my mom. You know, the bank, when he retired and took in his first Social Security check, wouldn't take it because it didn't look like his signature on all the cards. You know? So he says, well, hell, I don't know why she's giving her all that money. I'll have to call you back. Well, then he calls down to the house, bitching at my mom, why the hell are you giving her all this money? No, I'm sorry, I ain't giving her shit. So she called me at the bar that night because that's the only place she knew for certain I would be. Tells me I want you to come out here. And, you know, these three in the back could tell you, or at least two in the back could tell you, I'm afraid of my mama, you know? And when she's mad, she's a scary woman. And she would hit you with things, with butcher knives, spatulas, didn't matter. And so I wouldn't go. I said, well, yeah. But I took my friends with me, you know? Because I wasn't going to let her make me stay there. Because I knew I was in trouble, and I knew why. I knew it, you know? And so I'm out there, and she's going, blah, blah, blah. And I said, yeah, I did it. Why'd you do it? Well, you know, Mom, I'm dopey. I'm an alcoholic. I don't make enough. You know, I wasn't working for them. I was working for somebody else at that time. And I said, I don't make enough money to pay for all that. She said, why not? You don't pay any rent. Well, no. It just ain't enough, you know? However, there's this 800 number at work, Mom, and I promise, come Monday when I go back to work, I'll call. Pretty cool. It's got me out of this one, because I'm a finagler, right? So now I'm an alcoholic, I'm a dope, I'm a thief, and I'm a finagler. And so I left and went back to the bar, because we were in my friend's car. I got to go. No, we were in my car, and I had to take my friend back, because I'm not stupid. And so anyway, I got to work, and I did as I promised I would do, and I called this number, and my company sent me to rehab for a 28-day rehab, cost of $10,000, for me to learn that I can go to meetings for free. Yep. My mother took me there. I had a big old fatty world smoking it on the way with a good tall boy Budweiser, and I walked in, and I said, look, I'm good with drinking, and I'm good with smoking dope. I just need you to teach me how not to be cranked when I'm drinking and smoking dope. I figured they're just supposed to be experts. They could just teach me how to do that, right? They laughed at me and said, yeah, well, why don't you just hang out? So I hung out, and you know, the reality is I wasn't ready. So besides learning that I could go to meetings for free, I got a seed planted. And I got out of rehab, and by then they had taken my house away that I wasn't paying rent on. And moved all my furniture somewhere, I don't remember where it was. And I was not going to live with my parents at 28 years old and under those, because of all that. So I moved in with my dealer. I thought that was a good place to go, because that's where all my friends were. You know, I didn't hear that part in all those meetings I went to in that 28 days that I needed to change my lifestyle. I didn't hear that I needed to change the people I hung out with. So I went back there, and quite frankly, I stayed clean there for 7 months. But I started drinking in 15 days. And just as simple as that, I walked into a 7-Eleven, get a pack of cigarettes, looked over, there was a display of Budweiser Tall Boys, and said, those look good, snapped them, bought them, out the door I went, and I was on a run. So that was somewhere around Halloween. And on the 19th of January, I met this girl. And I was between Flavor of the Month. And I'd met her actually, I guess, one or two times before that at somebody's house, or I think it was at a dealer's house or something. And my other buddy said, no, that one's mine. I said, fine, take her, I don't care. So I didn't pay much attention to her. But, you know, she came in and she says, hey, do you remember me? I said, yeah. She goes, well, how you doing? I said, fine, you want to go outside and smoke some dope? Sure. Well, she didn't do any of that stuff, you know. So we went out, came back in, and I got plastered that night like I normally do. And she went home and woke up next morning, and we decided we were in love. That's how fast it happens in my world. Swear. And she says, well, I have this six-year-old kid. I said, well, you know, if we're going to put this together because we're in love, I got to figure out something, because I honestly did not believe in doing dope in front of kids. And I wouldn't have it. So I told her, I said, well, you know, I've kind of been going to these meetings off and on now. And I kind of think I have a way to stop doing that so it's not around your kid, but I'm probably going to need your support in that. So are you willing to do that? She says, are you willing to tell me your real name? Sure. So I told her my real name. She said, okay. And I don't know, I think the next day we went to a softball game. I got drunk again. And then that Sunday I went to a women's meeting. And on the 22nd of January was the last. No, 21st I got drunk. Because my bar was shutting down, so I had to give it a good farewell. And I remember that last night, and this is the most important part of my war stories, is I remember it was very cold, and I was outside in the street, in the middle of the street, in front of the bar, and I had a quarter Jack Daniels from behind the bar, and I was trying to drink it, and every time I up-tipped it, and I'd get it swallowed, it would automatically come up. And that's how I drank that entire fifth of Jack Daniels. I still cannot smell Jack Daniels today, because I will upset in a heartbeat. But that was my last night of drinking. I woke up the next morning on the 22nd. I went to a meeting that night, and I told her my real name, and she supported me through that during the duration of our relationship. And I've been sober ever since. So I can't tell you I was ready. I can tell you that for that six-year-old kid, I needed to change, because I wasn't going to have that around him. So I guess he was the person that God brought me to get me to where I'm at tonight. So I spent about 2-3 months being miserable. Miserable. Back to that thing between Halloween and the 19th, 20th, so January. I can tell you that I remember about 4.5 minutes. And I was on a total binge, total blackout. That is all those months. So I got there, I started doing meetings again. They kept telling me, keep coming back, it gets better, keep coming back. If you want to be happy, keep coming back, until I was so fucking sick of hearing, keep coming back, I wanted to choke them. And because I wasn't getting any happier. In fact, I was getting miserable. And I remember sitting in a meeting and, you know, talking to a God that I really didn't understand. I used to call my God Junior, because I didn't think he had done a whole lot for me in my life, and I wasn't going to give him any superiority above me, so he was a junior. So I was talking to Junior. And I said, Junior, you know, if anything about these people is true and I'm supposed to get happier here, you know, I need it to come, because I didn't get sober to be fucking miserable. Straight up, you know. And that was at a Friday night CA meeting. That was Cocaine Anonymous meeting. That was my home group in Bakersfield at that time. And on Saturday, and walked at my house Saturday morning, and walked these guys. And it was Redneck Mike, Easy Mike, and Woody Bell, and they opened my door, like, didn't even knock. It was like they paid my rent, you know? And that was another house I was living in without paying rent, by the way. And I'm the baby. And Redneck sat down in my chair, and he picked up my guitar, and which was a big no-no, and started playing it, and I'm looking at him like, who the fuck do you think you are? You know? And he says, you know, Farrah, when are you going to get your shit together and come ride with us? I don't know. I had a little 750 Honda Stopper. You know? It certainly was not going to keep up with their Harleys. You know? And it was a Honda. And, so my girlfriend, who promised to support me through all this, was back there going, I think she can go tomorrow. And, you know, looking back on it, I think she set me up. I really did. I was so miserable. So, I said, well, you know, I guess I can go for a little putt tomorrow. It's all right. And he says, okay, be at my house tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock with a full tank of gas. And I'm thinking, 7 o'clock on a Sunday? What the hell? But, you know, my sponsor kept telling me, Bear, you do anything you need to do for your sobriety, and it's going to happen for you, I promise. I kept getting all these damn promises along with those keep coming back. And I wanted to choke the people with the promises, too, by then, including my sponsor. And, all right, I'll go there. Well, they neglected to tell me that we were coming to Visalia. And they neglected to tell me that we were coming to a business meeting of Fifth Chapter, which was a clean and sober motorcycling club. And they neglected to tell me that I guess Sidrian, who was my girlfriend at the time, had actually set it up that I was supposed to join this club. So we're sitting there through this boring ass business thing, and well, this isn't a whole lot of fun, but at least I got a ride out of it, you know. And so towards the end of the meeting, it's the prospect report. Does anybody want the prospect? And Mike just kind of reached out and grabbed me and said, she does. What do I do? Sidney's over there going, mm-hmm. Okay. Sure, why not? And how much does this cost? And I'm looking at her and can we afford this? You know, because I was a newcomer. We were poor. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so they took me out in the parking lot and they showed me Redneck Spot and they said, this is cheat at that tire. Mm-hmm. Well, wherever it goes for the next 6 months, you go. Okay. I'm still looking at her like, can we afford this?
Mm-hmm.
And so you know what? That was the best 6 months of my life, man. And those guys taught me that I didn't have to be miserable and sobriety. They taught me that although it's a painful process to let go of my old compas, right, French forever, it can be done. And making new friends in this program can be a lot of fun. They taught me I didn't have to be a thief again. They taught me integrity. They taught me that I could love somebody and somebody could love me back without wanting something from me. They taught me that when my phone rang and I picked it up and they said, hey Bear, how you doing? They weren't concerned with whether I had alcohol, dope, money, gas, a car, the money to put the gas in the car to go get the drugs and the alcohol. That's what they taught me. They taught me that me standing right here, I'm no longer different. As long as I am honest with you, you'll be honest with me. And that makes us the same. And those men, those straight men, gave me my life back. And before they walked into my door that Saturday morning, I really didn't give a shit whether I lived or not. I really was concerned about that retirement past 30, figured somebody would come along somehow, because I really didn't expect to be alive after 30. I was doing some crazy shit out there. And it didn't matter. I didn't have any kind of conscious relationship with a God. The God that I knew was sending me to hell. Ask the preachers. Right? The God that I knew had brought nothing but pain to my life. And the God that I knew certainly could not love some big, fat, bush queer. That's the God that I knew when those men walked into my house. And what they showed me that first 6 months is that no matter where I went with them, I was accepted, I was hugged, and I was loved. Just for who I am standing right here before you. Because I'm still that big, fat, bush queer. Right? And I'm proud to be that person today. I'm proud of who I am today. I made a decision last week that I'm retiring from my club, which is a spinoff of Fifth Chapter when it folded in 1993 or something. And I put 24 years into Phoenix over motorcycling, trying to deliver that same message. And I've been fortunate enough to be able to deliver that same message to a few people. And that's all I wanted to do in this program, is deliver that message. And show people that you don't have to get sober and be miserable. You don't have to get off the bar stool and be and not be able to dance. You know? I can't show you how to shoot pool because I've never learned how to shoot pool again since I've been sober. It took me a little while to learn how to drive again because I started 11. I learned to do all that shit loaded. It's wonderful, man. I have a good time. Today, I got that house. I finally learned at 12 years of sobriety how to have a decent relationship. Because that first 10, 11 years, it was like that flavor of the year and month again. I didn't quite know how to do it. I have a relationship of 13 years. I got a job I've been at 17 years, surprisingly enough. I got my Harley, you know, and one of those guys is dead, and I often, when we're riding down the road, take a redneck mic and say, dude, what do you think? Would you be proud of me today? And I think you would be. I can tell you that you'll hear around the rooms, I don't know how many people are here just a few years, how many here are a bunch of years, it doesn't matter, but you know, you hear around the room, go to meetings, get a sponsor, read the book, everything Kurt told you to do. That's not how I did it. I've had two sponsors. I haven't had a sponsor in years. And I'm not telling you that because I'm not proud of it. I'm telling you that because I need to put that out there. I've worked through the step twice. I'm due for another one. Kurt kind of let me know that last week. Those three in the back are my temporary sponsors right now. And they're very good at pulling my covers. I would not suggest to do it the way I did it over the years. But, you know, they tell you when you come in that you're unique. And every program is unique, and I guess mine was unique. I have not read the book front to cover, because as I sit down and read, I go to sleep. But I figure in 24 years, I've gone to enough meetings, I've probably heard every single word in this book. I pay attention. It doesn't look like it, because I'll be back there playing on my phone, playing again. Doing that makes me focus on what I'm hearing. If I don't do that, they'll tell you I'm cross-talking horribly. And making smart-ass remarks or whatever. I can tell you, if you listen to those people saying, keep coming back, keep coming back, keep coming back, that no matter how much you want to choke them, please keep coming back. That's right. And no matter how much they tell you they love you, believe them, because they do. And if you really want a different life, and I'm not going to tell you it's all, you know, peaches and cream, if you want that, what do they call it, that pink cloud? Go down here to the Harley shop, get you a pair of 595 KDs that are rose colored. You can have rose colored glasses anytime you want. It'll make your life better. But that's not guaranteed. Your pink cloud is going to bust someday. And when it does, it's going to fall really hard on your ass. And it's going to hurt. And it's these people in this room that are going to get you through it. It's not going to be your wife, your mother, your father, your grandfather, your district cousin, and Yonkers. It's going to be these people right here in this room. Reach out to them, get the phone numbers, get a fucking sponsor. Please. Don't do it alone. And if they tell TV, don't do this at home. Yeah, don't do me at home. And you know, just keep coming to meetings. The program changed. When I got here, the room was filled with smoke, like from the ceiling down to about right here. And they served coffee at the tables, and they didn't have cool little styrofoam paper cups. And I was told to sit down, shut the fuck up, come to meetings in 90 meetings in 90 days, and when the meeting's over, empty the ashtrays and wash the coffee cups. Well, don't you think that's kind of like running that bathtub water and cooking that dinner I was worried about earlier? Was to me. But you know what? After those guys got done showing me what I could have, I wash coffee cups every night. And I'll empty ashtrays every night, and I'll do it today. And I don't even drink coffee anymore. I drink tea. You know? I will do whatever it takes today to keep my sobriety. It's not worth a woman. It's not worth a friend. It's not worth a family member. It's not worth a stranger. It's not worth another fellow of Alcoholics Anonymous. My best friends are sitting right there, and if they go out and get drunk, I will be there to get them home and to try to get them back here, but I will not go sit and drink with them because then I will be drunk. I love them, but then I'm going to have to love them from afar. You know, you've got to set boundaries. That's a boundary. You know, so if you're miserable and you got a lot of time, maybe you ought to go get another sponsor, like Kirby said. And maybe work the stuff like Kirby said. And if you're new and you're miserable, keep coming back because we love you. You can show up and ask for me if you want. If you can, get yourself a bike. There's a lot of people out there. Hey, it helps, man. You know what I got to tell you? There's a lot of times over the years that when I got really sitting in my shit, the reason I didn't drink is because I could not imagine taking my colors. And at the time, Doc Davidson, a lot of people here know Doc from years ago, Doc Davidson was my national president, and I could not imagine taking those colors off and handing them back to Doc and say, brother, I drank. And today I'm president of our club, and I cannot imagine taking my colors off and handing them to Kirk. Shut up, Nancy. Or giving it to Nancy. That means I don't have a vote. And Nancy's really the boss. I couldn't imagine taking my colors off and handing those guys to say, hey, I drank. So sometimes it's just something simple as that will keep you sober. Use every tool that they give you here. Every tool you can find. If you come up with an idea that works out here at your local Starbucks, cool. But make sure that you bring it back to these meetings on a regular basis. So, anyway, you guys, thank you so much for having me and enduring me for the last few minutes. Rick, thank you so much for inviting me and my buddies for coming down with me. And I love you guys. And thank you absolutely for being here for me.